Welcome to Understory on this, the 10th of April 2019. I'm Elizabeth Poe. Last week on the programme, former South Australia Premier Jay Weatherill described Australia's wasted decade around climate change because the fate of our planet was being used for petty political ends, especially as a way to destroy leaders. Despite this difficult policy environment, South Australian Labor was able to move from having no renewable energy to speak of in 2002 to achieving now 50% renewables. Jay Weatherill was a big part of that achievement. But in 2016, blackouts in South Australia could have potentially crushed renewable energy in that state and across the country because a focus on wind and solar and international events were blamed by the fossil fuel lobby and the Liberal federal government, quite wrongly, to explain why the lights had gone out. In fact, the downing of towers and power lines in unprecedented 250-kilometre-an-hour winds across South Australia had caused huge problems. But Australia's Prime Minister of the day didn't want to work with the facts, as were clearly outlined in the briefings, preferring to use the moment to criticise renewables. The PM's comments were also quite discouraging of investment in South Australia, at a time when car plants had closed down and the state was seeking to attract companies.
So we had the nation's leader and the nation's deputy leader attacking South Australia for its leadership on renewable energy, which is mildly galling given that a few months before in the September election, he was standing up taking credit for our leadership in renewable energy when he was campaigning in seats that he thought that was important in, and claiming credit for it on the basis of saying it was largely driven by his own renewable federal renewable energy target.
Jay Weatherill explained last week that it became clear to him that the national grid of operators weren't interested in addressing South Australia's needs, so there was nothing to do but create the state's own quite separate energy plan. This week, we'll find out what happened next. Understory's Adrienne Glamorgan went along to the Citizens Climate Lobby Conference to hear Jay Weatherill address a filled hall of citizens wanting multi-partisan action on climate change and to find out what South Australia had learned about neutralising the impact of corporate money from the fossil fuel industry through good policy and funding.
Where we got to as a state was when it became obvious to us that the national electricity market was not going to change anytime soon. There was this policy inertia at a national level. The national energy market operator was not operating the system in a way that was protecting South Australia's interests. We decided to take matters into our own hand, and so we established our own energy plan, which included a whole range of new initiatives, including putting in place our own state generator to make sure we had security of supply, putting in place the world's largest lithium-ion battery to stabilise our system when we had these sudden shocks to it for a whole range of reasons. And ironically, the call on the battery has not been through issues concerning the intermittency of renewable energy. It's actually been through the collapse of coal-fired generators that have fallen out of the system at a moment's notice, causing destabilisation to the system. So the new battery that we put in place, the world's largest lithium-ion battery, cost us $4.6 million over the next 10 years. It cost the company who installed it $90 million, but only cost us $4.6 million per annum over 10 years. The reason there's the difference is they can use it to trade on the market and make revenue. But critically important, they also, by introducing new competition into what is called the frequency control ancillary services market, something which maintains the frequency of the system within relevant bounds, they've actually been able to pull out of the South Australian part of the region $45 million of cost in the first 12 months of its operation. $46 million over 10 years, $45 million in savings to South Australian consumers in year one. So that's been the effect of this battery.
A word on how our national electricity market works. In fact, it's not as national as it sounds. For a start, Western Australia and Northern Territory are on separate grids. The national electricity market is an Eastern States wholesale electricity market, and AEMO is the Australian Energy Market Operator, managing the national energy market, and that extends from Queensland to South Australia, but not to Western Australia. And it's also involved in some gas transmission, plus national transmission planning, a short-term trading market for gas, and a separate financial trading market for electricity. Western Australia's own arrangements are relatively simple. Western Power is a statutory corporation, responsible for building, maintaining, and operating the electricity network within the Southwest Interconnected System, or SWIS. The SWIS stretches from Kalbarri to Albany to Kalgoorlie. Western Australia is separate from the national energy market, and Western Power isn't a member of the Australian Energy Market Operator. It's a system that's complex organisationally and economically, it would seem, but it's complex technically too, because it has to manage all sorts of issues like load and flux. A sudden drop in supply is one problem. So is a change in demand, with citizens' solar panels changing the shape of energy draw. Western Australia is particularly compromised, as it's a major producer of carbon gases by massive offshore gas production fields. And that has been its own hot-button issue, as evidenced a few weeks ago when the EPA, that's the state's Environment Protection Authority, made a decision to overturn its own brand new decision requiring offsets from those large fossil fuel companies. This turnaround came after a few days of media comments by the industry and the Premier. Now, Understory is a solutions-focused outfit, bringing civil society media some of the news that doesn't always get around, so this issue with renewables versus fossil fuels may not be a new one. But in what is unavoidably shaping up as a climate change election, the news must focus on the question of where to next, with our energy sector as a starting point. Jay Weatherill.
Remember, this is the nation's largest machine, the national electricity market. This extends from Bundaberg all the way down to Ceduna. It's a big machine. So some lightning struck two circuits in Queensland, very unusual for both of them to be simultaneously struck. It caused a cascading effect where each of the segments of the national electricity market were islanded. Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia, all the interconnectors popped off, and they still don't know why. South Australia was the only place where we didn't have load shedding as a consequence because of the big battery. So it shows that it can respond in milliseconds to these relevant challenges. It also gives us the capacity to deal with a much more complex grid, which is now having to incorporate renewable energy. Now, some might argue, well, this imperative about introducing renewable energy has had the consequence of pushing coal-fired power stations out of the system. And there's no doubt that it's been an important contribution. Another important contribution has been the slow growth in demand for electricity more generally. But the truth is that even if governments decided as a policy response they were not going to do that, they weren't going to promote renewable energy, even if we're going to ignore our international obligations, citizens would insist on this. I mean, much of the changes that are actually occurring to the structure of the national electricity market and even the Western Australian market are because people are using their own money to put rooftop solar on their own houses. So whatever governments think about this, citizens are demanding action. And if you actually think about the history of this, obviously internationally the world's citizens, with the unusual exception of the United States now, but every single country in the world had signed up to Paris, commitments to take action on climate change. Australian governments have made commitments to take action on climate change. Even the Abbott government signed up to Paris, and I noticed Tony Abbott is now back in the car in relation to taking action on climate change as he fears for the loss of his seat. But this is the point. Citizens are demanding action. Citizens in his own seat are demanding action. Even if Australian governments were to retreat from this agenda, state governments would be obliged to step in. And if state governments retreated from the agenda, local governments would step in because citizens demand it. This isn't going away, and in fact, all the international movements that we're seeing around the world, school children striking in the streets, a whole range of international regulatory organisations taking action on climate change, corporations waking up to the need to take action on climate change. I'll give you one powerful example of the shift in thinking that's occurring even in corporate Australia, even in the fossil fuel industry. I was at the World Government Summit in Dubai a few weeks ago. In the energy section of the summit, the head of energy for Shell said that they've completely changed their future planning processes. Instead of thinking about future demand, future supply, having regard to consumer preferences and where they saw exploration going, they now put 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees scenario planning, and then work backwards to see what the world looks like in terms of energy, and then work backwards to find out how Shell can live in that world. And their conclusion is, they think, coal has to go. They're hoping there's still a future for gas and oil. But nevertheless, even corporations that are fossil fuel industry corporations are realising that they have to be part of an international consensus about taking action on climate change. So this is inexorable, it's inevitable, it's going to happen, and politicians that get in the way are going to be run over. And if you're wondering why I'm not still Premier, it had nothing to do with action on climate change. In fact, as it happened, we got a 1% swing towards us at the last election, but complicated redistributions meant we weren't elected. But for those of you that follow politics would appreciate the significance of this. On the last day of the election campaign, all I was talking about was energy, because that was a winning issue for us, and our opponents wanted to talk about anything other than energy. Now, back in September 2016, 2 years before the election, if you had said to anybody in South Australia that I would be wanting to talk about energy because of the statewide blackout, they would have said, you are crazy. But the great irony was that even in the face of what was really a catastrophe, you know, a minor, you know, emergency for the state, the community did not resolve from their support for renewable energy. They continued to demand politicians support renewable energy. They didn't accept the propaganda that was being run by the coal industry about the cause being renewable energy. And they maintained a very strong perspective about the importance of continuing to invest in climate change. So there is absolutely no doubt that this is a potent political force. People are now looking around the world and seeing the climate emergencies and are beginning to say we have to act now. And I think that's what you're seeing with our children. They're demanding adults take action on climate change. They're shaming us into taking the steps that are necessary for the future of the planet. My sense of it is that the momentum is really building very quickly. I mean, if you look over the course of your own lifetime, see the pace of change that's occurring in relation to society. When Ross Garnaut wrote his report, he factored in a presumption that the cost of solar PVs would fall by about 3% per annum every year. His report's only 2007, so only 12 years ago. They've fallen by 90%. So the pace of technological change is quickening. The international community have created an international framework for action on climate change. While it seems a bit grim here, there are some pretty impressive things that are going on around the world. My sense of it is that we're on the cusp of pretty major leaps forward. And once this dialogue about respecting the planet, it's almost... The overwhelming sense of being at this World Government Summit in Dubai is that we're bumping up against the edges of the natural constraints in our planet and our social systems. If you look at the role of the corporation around the world, and that's really the principal vector for the difficulties here, they're now, this whole environmental, social and governance risk is now front and centre. You know, it's now not available to say we can make money any way we like and it doesn't matter what happens to them. You know, the population, our natural environment. So my sense of it is that the pace of change is accelerating, and maybe we just will have enough time. I mean, it's about life on Earth, isn't it? It's an existential crisis, and I think we'll choose survival. You know, I'm sure we won't choose oblivion. Thank you.
Thanks for Morning Understory with me, Elizabeth Poe, and Adrian Glamorgan, bringing you former South Australian Premier Jay Weatherill as he spoke to a group known as Citizens Climate Lobby, worth checking out for their ongoing great work. You can listen again and share the programs by streaming us online. Just Google Understory, blog, RTRFM. We'll be back next week, same time, same planet, when there'll be more to explore with the environmental focus of Understory.